All right, so we are now recording. Okay, so I want to put the identifier on. I'm Tacy-Ann Rosolowski, and I'm reading the script from here. Tacy-Ann Rosolowski interviewing Dr. Catherine DeAngelis for the Alma De Amorani Renaissance Woman in Medicine Oral History Project, run by the Women in Medicine Legacy Foundation. This whole interview is also being jointly supported by the Johns Hopkins Medical School Library. Today is December 22nd, 2020, and the time is just a couple minutes after 2 p.m. at my time in Houston, Texas. And this interview is being conducted virtually via recorded Zoom interview. Just generally, where are you located, Dr. DeAngelis?
Right now, I'm at our family home in a place in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania, Northeast. It's called Lackawaxen, Pennsylvania.
All right.
It's very rural. So my husband and I have been self-isolating here rather than Baltimore because it's a lot safer from coronavirus.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this interview is being conducted during this crazy, crazy year. Well, just a little bit of a few introductory statements. Dr. DeAngelis won the Alma De Amorani Renaissance Woman in Medicine Award in 2007, and you also served on the foundation's board. When did that start?
Oh, dear Lord, I can't recall. Okay. I'm sorry, I can't tell you. It's in my CV.
Okay, I'll search around. So just a few things. Dr. DeAngelis is a Johns Hopkins University Distinguished Service Professor Emerita and Professor Emerita at the Johns Hopkins University Schools of Medicine and School of Public Health. She served as the first woman editor-in-chief of JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, from 2000 to 2011. And in 2016, you published a memoir entitled Pursuing Equity in Medicine, One Woman's Journey, which I've been looking at and very interesting. So I want to thank you so much for participating in this project. I'm glad
we're finally together.
Yes, delighted to finally be able to see you.
I'll send you a copy when it gets published of a book I wrote over the last, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 months. It's a murder mystery, but it has two parallel plots. One is an existentialism plot combined with the murder mystery that occurs in a hospital, of course.
Oh, wow.
But when that comes about, when that gets published, I'll send you a copy.
I'd love to read it. I mean, I love murder mysteries, and that'd be, you've been keeping yourself out of trouble during COVID, I can tell.
I don't know about out of trouble. Don't talk to my husband, okay?
All right. Won't address that. So I wanted to, as I mentioned before we turned on the recorder, since you have your memoir out and you talk a lot about your early experiences, I wanted to try to capture some different stories here as we're having this recorded conversation. But there was one that I really was hoping you would tell on the record, and that is how your father encouraged you to become a doctor. Now, when did you decide that you wanted to be a doctor?
I think I was about 4 years old, and I started asking for a doctor's kit at Christmas. If you read the memoir, you know that I didn't realize it until I took a sociology course in college, but we were certified poor. You could have fooled me and my sisters. I have a wonderful family, and we're all very close. My dad, I had two sisters, actually three, but one died. So there were three girls. My poor father lived with three daughters, a wife, and his mother-in-law. One bathroom. Oh, what can I say? But he was wonderful. And I always found what he was doing and the way he was thinking far more interesting than the things my mother was doing. I took my turn with the household chores and that, but I was much happier helping my dad. And
what does your dad do?
Oh, he worked in a factory. He was he had an eighth grade education. It's interesting, the people in his class, one of whom became a physician, the other was the coach, many of them were teachers. They all said he was the smartest kid in the class, but he was the oldest son in an immigrant Italian family, so he went to work after he finished eighth grade. But he was really smart. He read a lot, but it was newspapers and stuff. And we used to go for walks in the woods, and we'd talk about all kinds of things. So that when I took a biology botany course in college, there was an extra 20-point question that nobody in the class got but me, because I knew the answer because I was walking in the woods with my dad. Anyhow, that's just the kind of effect he had on me. But when I was four, I realized that there were two people who seemed to make a difference in my family, and they were very much honored. One was the priest, and the other was the doctor who came to see my grandmother. That's when they did house calls. And my mother had a special towel for each of them, and one liked cherry pie, the other liked apple pie, and she would make the pie for them, of course, when they came. And I knew I could never be a priest because of, well, women still can't be priests, and that still bugs me, but that's another story. So I thought it must be best to be a doctor. It was only later that the science really turned me on. But back then, when I'm 4 or 5 years old, so I kept asking for a doctor's kit, and I kept getting a nurse's kit. A doctor's kit was black, the nurse's kit was pink, and to this day, I hate pink.
if you want on that one.
give me something pink. Anyhow, I would, by the time I was about, I guess it was my third Christmas when I got the nurse's kit, and I wouldn't even open it. I just put it away, never opened it, which was unusual. I mean, because Christmas was a big deal, and I loved Christmas. I played, but I just put it on the side, never opened it. And so one morning he said to me, "Why aren't you opening your doctor's kit?" I said, "That's not a doctor's kit." I said, "That's a nurse's kit. I don't want to be a nurse. I want to be a doctor." And I said, "Doctor's kits are black, not pink." I said, "And there's a cap in there, red cross on it. That nurse's cap. Doctors don't wear nurse's caps." He said, "Okay." So the next morning was a weekend. So the next morning, I go into the kitchen for breakfast, and he has one of his old white shirts, and he puts it on me, and he had taken the nurse's cap, cut out the red cross, had pinned it onto the sleeve, and he handed me a black doctor's bag. He had painted the pink bag black. He said, "Now you're a doctor." And that very much symbolized to me exactly the kind of encouragement I was to continue to get from him. And he just kept telling me, "You can do and be anything you want if you're willing to work hard enough for it and be patient." And my mother was wonderful. She's a wonderful woman. But to her, the best degree I ever got was the MRS. Once I got married, then I was okay. The doctor, I did become a nurse first because we didn't have the money to even go to college, never mind medical school. But
what was it that interested you so much about your father's arena of roles at the time?
Well, everything he did was so much more interesting to me. I mean, we put in sidewalks in a home. They finally saved up enough to buy a house that, needed a lot of work. It was fascinating to me that we put in sidewalks, but the work that went into figuring out the measuring and mixing the cement and that stuff, I helped him put a new roof on the garage. That to me was much more interesting than scrubbing floors or washing clothes or stuff like that. We took down a tree. It was a big maple tree in our yard. And for him to determine how to cut what branches and how to cut what so that it wouldn't fall on the house. I mean, what he was doing was trigonometry. He was doing all kinds of neat stuff. I didn't know it, because I was at that point, I was probably 8 or 9 years old helping him. But everything he did, we planted a big garden. And that was so much more interesting to me to watch things grow.
And now, where are you in the birth order in your family?
I was the third girl, but the second one died before she was a year old. She died of pneumonia. Mm. And then I came along, and then I have a sister younger than me. So I'm the middle child.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, was your older sister also as interested in your dad, or did she end up being kind of more a traditional?
Oh, no. My older sister is, she's wonderful. But to her, she was typical. She wanted to be a mother. Mm-hmm. She wanted to have a nice house. And to this day, I mean, I talk to her every day. I talk to both sisters, one twice a day, and my older sister once a day. She is so happy because she's got her little house in the place where we grew up, never moved from there. The only traveling she did was on her honeymoon. And when my husband and I took both sisters and my brother-in-law to we went to Alaska, we went to Israel, we went to Greece, we went to Italy, but otherwise she didn't want to travel. She's just a very homebody. She took 1 year in business school and was a secretary for a while and then got married.
Temperaments, isn't it funny?
Oh, my younger sister is a nurse.
Yeah.
And she again has kids who are wonderful. And I mean, I have 7 nieces and nephews who are like my kids. And I know God's a man, because if God were a woman, I'd have about a dozen kids. Of course, I wouldn't be a doctor. But God works in strange ways. I really think Dante was correct in the Divine Comedy. I think God is a great comedian and has a very weird sense of humor.
And, I was going to ask you about the place of religion and spirituality in your home life when you were young. Tell me about that.
Well, both parents were devout Catholics, although my father, his take on Catholicism and, he was not a churchgoer. I could remember when my mother worked as a waitress on Friday and Saturday nights. So on Friday nights, he would come home. He would go out to a movie or something, but he would come home And he a snack that he was great at making eggs. And he would frequently, for his eggs, he would put pepperoni or salami with it. And we'd go to him, we'd say, you know, Daddy, you can't eat meat, it's Friday. And so he'd say, oh, and then he'd make the sign of the cross over the salami. He says, you are fish. And there you go. He said, I'm eating fish. It was that kind of attitude. I mean, he was an incredible man. He would never do anything dishonest. He was always for the underdog. He was so generous. I mean, if you want to talk about someone whose spirituality was present in how they lived their life, that was my dad and my mom. Now, my mom was more overtly Catholic. We would never miss Mass. We would always go to, you know, the Sunday school. You know, the priest and the nuns were, you know, special people. And so, I mean, I grew up with that. And you know, my mother would say the rosary every night. And not my dad wouldn't, but my mom would with us. And of course, after a while, the rosary got to me because I was saying, how many times can you say the same prayer and not lose your sense of thought? And so to me, it became a mantra. It was only later in my spiritual life that I discovered Maranatha, the Christian mantra. But the spirituality came from early and from observing others.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in your memoir, you had said that the concepts of fairness and equality were really, really strong in your home. And you just mentioned that again, you know, in connection with your dad's spirituality.
It was like he was an Italian man, and he would expect him to, you know, sort of be dominant and stuff. But he was funny because he'd say to me over and over and over, he said, you don't let anybody push you around. He said, you're a girl, but you're just as smart and as wonderful as any boy. And I mean, I was convinced of that. I never doubted that a minute because he reassured me and he showed me. He said, look, he said, you helped me take down the tree, you helped me plant, you put a roof on the thing. He taught me how to work, to work on a car. I mean, I was able to take, it was interesting in high school. One of the things we did was there was an old car there. And so the girls were supposed to cook something and the boys were to take this carburetor apart and put it back together. And I said, how about you let the guys cook? I can cook. My mother's a very good cook and I learned to cook just by being with her. But I said, I want to take that carburetor apart. And they said, girls don't do that. I said, who said so? And so they said, well, go ahead. And I took it apart, put it back together. None of the boys were able to do it completely without having leftover parts, but I could. And it was just that kind of attitude. You can do anything. And don't ever let anybody tell you that you can't do anything because you're a girl.
Now, as you've, spoken with other women of your generation and even slightly younger, how important was that kind of home influence in helping women have the confidence to go into, to become physicians?
Well, quite honestly, I know so many women physicians and women lawyers who had very strong father support. And I think it's very important. I mean, now I think it was because men were so dominant then. It may be a little less of a problem or an issue now because so many women are becoming professionals. In fact, when I was a physician, well, as a physician, we lived in Baltimore. We had a house that had a room. It had an apartment upstairs. I mean, a separate entrance and everything. So one of my women colleagues, her husband was a writer. She's a physician. And she had two boys who essentially were like my husband and I kids, because they're in and out of my house as much as they were their own house. And I remember one day, her youngest son, Nick, asked her, she said, "Mom, can boys be doctors too?" Because all the doctors he knew were women. And his father was a writer.
Oh, that's really funny. Sure. That must have done your heart good.
Oh, yeah, it was funny. We still laugh about that.
Yeah.
But I think the influence, for me, the influence of my father made an incredible difference. I don't know if I had had a brother, if it would have been as strong, but I like to believe it would have. I think it would. I mean, he saw in me something that was different than my sisters. And he just encouraged them.
Yeah, invaluable.
Now, but I want to tell you one other story about how he taught me some things. He was a hunter. I mean, he hunted for food. We ate the fish. I went fishing with him a lot, which was wonderful. And I'd go hunting with him for rabbits, you know. So he didn't have a dog, so I'd kick the rabbit out and he'd shoot. Anyway, he taught me to shoot. Mm-hmm. So to this day, I hate guns. I don't want to go anywhere near it. But he was very careful. The gun he had, well, he had two guns. He would keep the ammunition completely separate and locked up. And we wouldn't go near those guns unless he was there. My two sisters didn't want to have anything to do with it. But I wanted to learn to do everything. And so he had just saved up to buy a hunting rifle, which is a pretty powerful rifle. And he would target practice. He'd go down to this place where there were some rats that could be seen. And he'd shoot at the rats to target practice. But he'd stand on kind of a hill, a mound. It was kind of a round hill or a mound, and shoot down. And I went with him, and he was showing me his new gun. And I said, "Can I shoot it?" He says, "It has a big kick." I said, "I don't care." I was now about 11 or 12. He said, "Okay." So he put the gun on his shoulder. And he says, "Now remember, it has a big kick." I said, "I don't care." He said, "Okay, you know what to do." He said, when I count to three, he said, "You tell me when you're ready. When I count to three, you pull the trigger." So that's what I did. I pulled the trigger. Now, he grabbed the barrel, but he couldn't grab it completely. So I got hit in the shoulder, knocked head over heels down the hill. And I lay there and I felt like someone had just run me over. And he looked down, he said, "You okay?" And of course I said, yeah, I'm fine. And he helped me back up the hill. He says, "You want to do it again?" I said, "Uh-uh." He said, "Okay." He said, "Just remember, you know, guns are terrible." Now I had a terrible black and blue mark.
Yeah.
And when my mother saw it, she went berserk. And I told her that I had bumped into something. But my father, is being honest, said, not what happened. And then my mother said, you don't go anywhere near a gun ever. I said, I can't promise that. He said, well, you know, you don't lie. So, but he taught me that things are dangerous. And, right. You know, okay.
And was honest about it. And
absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, responsibly honest about it, which is really, really
important. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I never did shoot a big gun again.
Yeah.
In fact, as an adult, I hate guns.
I really identify with that story. My dad used to take me target shooting and hunting, too. We would go to the dump and shoot rats, you know.
There you go. There you go.
Got the lecture on safety and all of that stuff, you know. Very important. Yeah. No, I mean, it was, it was a different era in terms of.
Yeah, it was completely relationship different.
With guns. Yeah, very different. Now, I wanted to kind of go back to the issue of religion in your life, because I know that you first wanted to go to be a doctor, but then work in Africa with an organization called the Mary Knoll Sisters.
Yes, I wanted to be a nun.
You wanted to be a nun?
I wanted to be a missionary nun.
Okay.
And I went to nursing school, the 3-year hospital nursing program, which didn't cost anything. So my obviously we can afford it because it didn't cost anything. I had excellent training, but I wanted to be a Mary Knoll nun. You know, a lot of Catholic girls are familiar with Bernie Becomes a Nun book. In fact, someone about 5 years ago sent me a copy. I don't know where she found it, but it was still around. But anyway.
You feel you had a sense of vocation? Where did that desire come from?
I don't know, but I thought, you know, I wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to help people. I wanted to serve them. I had a real deep sense of spirituality. Mm-hmm. And it made sense to me to be a missionary nun, a doctor missionary nun. And Mary Knoll seemed to be such a wonderful place. They did missions. It was in Ossining, New York. But I was, you know, 17 when I graduated high school. And my father refused to sign. You had to be 21 to go in the convent then, or at least that one. And he said, look, you stopped listening to me when you were about 5 years old. He said, yeah, you're going to go listen to them and they don't make any sense. So he said, no, we won't sign. He said, you go to nursing school. And because the teachers and the guidance counselor at my high school told my parents and me that women who wanted to be doctors had to be nurses first. Now, that wasn't true, but I think they probably said that knowing that my parents couldn't afford college, much less med school. And, you know, girls didn't become doctors back then.
Right, so, exactly.
So anyway, I went to the 3-year nurses program, which I loved. I loved being a nurse. And I did a lot of extra stuff and helping the doctors and stuff like that, and learned to do.
And just for the record, you went to the Scranton State General Hospital School of Nursing. And when did you graduate from that?
That's right.
When did you graduate from that program?
1960.
Okay.
And I was 20 years old when I graduated. And I still was not 21. My birthday's in January, so when I graduated, it was like May or June. I had 6 months or so. So I said, okay. So one of my classmates and I, she decided that she wanted to go and work in New York, where she met the man she married. But so I said, okay, I'll go with her. And because it was close to Ossining, where Mary Knoll is. So I went there and I actually made an appointment to have an interview at the Maryknoll Convent. And I took the train up to Ossining and then the cab to the place for the interview. And when I was there, I met supposedly I was to meet the novice, the nurse, the nun in charge of novices, but she was ill that day. You talk about God's sense of humor. And so in walks this woman who I swear was about 150 years old and very prim and proper, which was fine with me. That's the kind of nuns that I got used to. And I told her what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a doctor. And she says, oh, no, you're already a nurse. We need nurses. So you'll be a nurse, and that will be great because we need lots of nurses. And anyway, she said, then she was upset because I had never gone to a Catholic school. I said, well, there were no Catholic schools for me to go to. She said, well, you know, you might hold back your class. So what I suggest you do is you go back and take some courses in religion and theology, and then you come back here for us, and you'll be one of our nurses who's a novice, and that will work out. You won't hold back the class. Well, on the train back, I felt like crap. And I'm thinking, why do I feel so lousy? And I realized I wanted to be a doctor. I didn't want to be a nurse. And I wasn't holding back anybody. I would know the answer to any possible religious question they could ask someone coming in to be a nun. And I felt like this is wrong. This is just wrong. So I came back, and the following weekend, I went, I took the bus from New York to my home in Old Forge, Pennsylvania, and I went to see my chemistry teacher. Now, I had a chemistry teacher who was magnificent, and he had encouraged me to think about medical school and stuff. So I went to see him, and I told him what had happened, and I said, I want to be a doctor. He said, I've been waiting for you to tell me this. He said, call your mom and tell her you're going with me. We're going to Wilkes College. He said, you have to go to college. Now, this is like May, I guess it was May or June or something of that year. And he said, I'll get you back home in time for dinner. So he made a phone call to the dean of admissions at Wilkes, it was then Wilkes College, which was in Wilkes-Barre, which was about 15 miles from where I grew up, my home. And we went down there, and on his word only, they accepted me to college the following September. Now, I subsequently took tests and stuff, but it was incredible. And he was able, and they gave me a scholarship, which was amazing. And I said, well, I could work, they didn't have any infirmary. I said, I could work like two nights a week and we all set up an infirmary and stuff, you know, to sort of pay back. And so the rest is history. I graduated from there and you know, you have to kind of go a little bit where the wind takes you.
Absolutely. So you graduated from Wilkes College in 1965.
Yes, because I worked that year. Mm-hmm. I worked and 1 year in New York, and I worked double shifts for 6 months to make enough money to hold me through my first year of college.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, the dates are interesting because, of course, this was the 60s now, and the country is starting to become quite turbulent with social justice and civil rights and women's rights. So did you have any time to notice any of that? I mean, how did that historical situation affect you at the time?
You bet I did. I was the class president at Wilkes.
Wow.
For the 4 years. And my senior year, I was the head of the student government. And I made sure that women had a say in everything. And it just happened. I was a little older than most of the students because I'd already been a nurse. And because I was a nurse, a lot of students came and, you know, confided a lot of things in me, knowing they could trust me. And so it was easy to be a leader there.
What kinds of things did you hear from the students?
Well, it's interesting to me. One of the amazing things was the young boys, especially the freshmen, who would come to me and all upset because they'd had just the normal interactions that guys go through. And they came to me all upset, worrying that they were gay. And I said, look, you need to come and we need to talk about this a lot. I said, because from what you tell me, you're no more gay than any guy I know. And they couldn't believe it. But I got to know a lot of them and to help them through that little series. And there were all kinds of personal stuff that people told me about that I could help them with. And I got the doctor on the corner to back me up. Although it was interesting to me that when he'd have a young patient, he'd call me and ask me what he should do. Not medically, not the physical part, but the emotional part. Mm-hmm. And when you can deal with that part of somebody, now I could take care of their, if they had simple colds or something, or even if they had pneumonia, I knew what they had and I could call the doctor. And he would take my word after a couple months, he'd take my word and he'd write a prescription. Like for some simple things like, you know, kids have pneumonia and stuff like that, but they get over it fast.
And where do you think you got the ability to, you know, have that emotional intelligence, basically? I mean, because you're a relatively young woman and yet you seem to have really dealt with these situations in a really sophisticated way.
My mother was kind of everybody's counselor. Hmm. Everybody in the family, everybody in the neighborhood, people would come from the next towns over and talk to her. She had an eighth grade education too, but her spirituality, I think, helped her to understand, and she helped so many people. And I think I got that part from her. And, you know, to me, it came natural. I didn't really think anything special about it. That's just the way it was.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, you know, as your life evolves, you kind of discover these gifts you have, you know, as you're presented with more and more complicated situations to respond to.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that in the memoir that I wrote, I said I had discovered from experience that there were the four T's for a good leader. And it's interesting how many times I've had people repeat those back to me, or they print that page out of the book and put it on bulletin boards. I've seen it on bulletin boards with the
share it here for people who will listen to this interview.
Well, I said good leaders have four traits, all of which begin with T. One of which is tough-mindedness. Not tough, tough-mindedness. That means if you have an idea or you have a desire to do something and you know it's right and it's good, you don't give it up because you fail or because somebody tries to talk you out of it. And the second T is tenacity, which means you hang on And it doesn't matter how many times you fail, you keep trying. Because eventually, if it is a good idea, if it's something you really want, you just keep trying till you get it or you solve it. And the third is a very difficult one for women, and that is to have a thick skin. Because believe me, you cannot personalize anything. And you just have to sort of say, all right, you know, you can do all these things to me, but you're not going to break me down spiritually. And so I have thick skin. And the fourth is easy for women, and that's to be to have a what's the I'm blocking. Excuse me, I'm having a senior moment here. Jimbo, what's the fourth one?
Tough mind, target.
Tender-hearted. My husband remembered.
There we go. So was there a particular experience that really taught you about the thing?
He just said that's because you're so tender-hearted. I give him a hard time all the time. It's the tough-minded and tenacity that drives him crazy.
It's really funny. So was there a particular experience that taught you about the importance of the thick skin? You said that was hard for women.
Oh, man, I can fill volumes of stories of where you need thick skin, of people treating you badly simply because you're a woman. And that's why, to me, and the title of my book was Equity, Not Equality. Mm-hmm. Women are not equal to men, and men are not equal to women. Men can't have babies, okay? Women don't have the physical strength that men have. But equity means that you're both given the equality part comes, you're given equal credit or equal payment for equal work, okay? And equity also, to me, means you set up a situation so that people who are lesser with one trait but have another trait that more than makes up for it, you seek to get that balance for them. And you help them with the weaker part so that they can shine with their stronger part, and then they can use their stronger part to help somebody who is weaker in that part. And it works wonderfully.
Now, you went after Wilkes College, where you graduated in 65, then you went on to medical school. And I assume that was one of those places where you began having to learn how to get a thick skin.
Oh, yeah. Except I had the most wonderful classmates. I mean, it was interesting. I was accepted to Philadelphia schools. Of course, I learned one thick skin I needed that was really tough. When I went for an interview at one of the Philadelphia schools, it was one that a lot of the doctors from this area graduated from. My first interview was with a guy, and I don't call him a gentleman because he wasn't. He sat behind his desk and sort of sat back, and he said, "Miss DeAngelis," he said, "I don't understand why you're wasting your time and mine with this interview." And I expected the usual: you're a woman, you're taking the place of a man, you're going to get married, you're going to have kids, you're not going to see blah, 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 blah. Well, I had the response to all that. Women live longer than men. Men get sick more often than women. Anyway, but I said, "Gee, sir, why do you say that?" And he said, "Because we already have our quota of guineas for next year." Now, Guineas, as you might well know, is a very derogatory term for Italians. And I felt like he had just punched me in the stomach, because I thought of the sacrifices my parents had made to help me to go to school and to get to that point. And I looked at him and I said, you know, you're right. I don't belong here. And I got up, walked out, and I swore I would never set foot in that place again. And it was interesting because about, I don't know, 15, 20 years later, they wanted me to come and interview. They wanted me to interview for the deanship of the medical school there. And I refused. And I've been asked, I can't tell you how many times, to go there and give a talk. I refuse. And I've told them why. And I said, I know I should give it up, except I promised my father, I never told him about this. It would have broken his heart. But I said, I will never set foot in that building. I mean, I'd be happy to speak someplace else. I've spoken all over Philadelphia at all the medical schools there, as a matter of fact, not that one. And it's in one way, it's sad because I don't like to hold the grudge, but that was a promise I made to my dad, unknown to him, and I would never break it. Mm-hmm. But it was terrible.
I mean, some slights like that are just too deep. They really are.
Exactly. And that's why I identify so much with people now who are people look down on them because of some physical trait. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not like me, therefore I don't like you. You're not as good as me. That's ridiculous. Anyhow.
So in medical school, you said this University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine, and you said your classmates were really delightful. What was the learning environment there like for you as a young woman?
Well, first of all, let me tell you why I chose Pitt. The only reason I went there for an interview was because the physician with whom I did research for 3 of my 4 years at Wilkes, including all summers, he was an allergist immunologist. And I learned a great deal about doing research there. He graduated, he did his immunology and allergy specialty training at Pitt, and he loved it. And he said, look, you've got to go look at that place. It's a sleeper. And I said, okay. So out of respect for him, I went there. And while I was there, I was interviewed by 2 people, a gentleman who had been in the Navy, who is just such a sweetheart of a guy, kind of gruff, but one of those teddy bear gruffness, you know? Mm-hmm. And then my main interview was with a woman, Penna Drew, who was a very beautiful, stately woman. And while we were talking, she reached in her drawer and took out a little pipe with a diamond chip in it, and she lit it up and she smoked this pipe while she's talking to me. It, with my permission, of course. She said, do you mind if I smoke? And I thought she was going to take out a cigarette, which would have surprised her. But it wasn't. It was this little dainty pipe. And I just fell in love with her because she was so wonderful. Obviously, very smart. She was, you know, very well respected. And I just thought it was great. And she took me around and showed me some of the things. And I thought, you know, this is a really interesting place. So I was accepted to 2 Philadelphia schools and was put on the waiting list for another. But I said, I'm going to Pitt. And I have never been sorry that I made that choice. First of all, the first day of class, you know, I'm sitting in a room with about 120 or 110 other students, and mostly guys. And we were asked to just stand up, give our name, and tell where we graduated from, where was our college. And I'm hearing all this, oh, I'm Harvard, I'm NYU, I'm Stanford, I'm, you know, all these big shot schools. And I get up and I said, you know, Wilkes College. And I could see people turning to each other saying, where's that, you know? When I graduated, nobody asked where Wilkes College was. By then it was Wilkes University. But it was interesting because never, never once did my classmates treat me any differently than they did the male classmates. There were only, well, in my graduating class, there were only seven of us women. Because back then, there weren't that many women who were accepted.
Out of how many? The class of how many?
I think our class graduated 104, 105, and there were seven women.
Yeah. Why do you think that was, you know, that there was just that lack of difference drawn?
Well, it was the same kind of reason why the guidance counselors said girls needed to be nurses first, because girls were nurses and guys were doctors. It was just, you know, girls don't know science. Girls don't know math. You know, girls aren't going to dedicate their whole life to, you know, taking care of patients. No. Who takes care of the family? It's the mother. It isn't the father. But let's forget about that, you know. But it was just the attitude of the times. The guys had the brains. The guys knew science. The guys were the leaders. And women were followers.
So why do you think that wasn't happening in your medical school class?
Well, my classmates, I think, I don't know. I guess I didn't say that was true of some of the teachers because
I had
been really bad. But the guys, I mean, we just got along. And I was a little older than most of them. There was, I guess, only one or two who were about my age, but I pretty much was older than the others. And for some reason, again, people would come and talk to me and tell me things that I know they wouldn't tell anybody else.
Interesting, yeah.
And we were just, you know, one of them said, you're like a mother figure. I said, I'm only 2 years older than you. They said, no, it has nothing to do with age.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, whatever.
And you were giving them an old soul.
Yeah, well, that's it. I'm an old soul. And they knew that they could trust me with anything.
So what was the situation with the faculty? What was the situation with the faculty attitudes?
Well, in my freshman year, in the physiology course, we were told that one of the final things on the final exam was you had to think up an experiment, write it up, and project the results. Now, if there's one thing I knew, it was how to do research. I'd done it for 3 years, including summers. So I wrote the paper, handed it in, along with my physiology partners. There are usually six. They put us in groups of six for anatomy and physiology. Now, the professor for that course was an Asian gentleman. And it was well known that he didn't think women belonged in medicine. And for some reason, they slipped up and assigned me to him, to his group, because they tried not to put women in with him. So anyway, it's like the end of the year, and so I was it was a Friday afternoon, and my plan was to go back and spend the weekend working, studying for tour courses. Well, it's Friday afternoon. We go to the physiology class. He hands out the papers, and on my paper is an F. And he says, come see me. And I went to see him, and I said, I don't understand. He said, don't worry about understanding. He said, I want a completely different paper on my desk Monday morning. He said, otherwise you fail the course. So I went back to my room, and I'm thinking, this is bizarre. Why can I study for two final exams? And it took a lot to, even though I know how to do research, you have to put references and stuff. I know I can't do that. And this is not fair. So I talked to my classmates, and we talked about it, and they couldn't figure it out because they all got B's, or there was one guy got an A, or, you know, but everybody passed. And I read their papers, and they were fine. But mine was easily as good. In fact, it was better than at least two of them. So anyway, I went back to my room, and Friday night I'm there, and I decided I better study first. So I'm studying, and I fell asleep. And I got up and I went down to the bathroom, and someone had cracked the mirror, and there was a slice of the mirror, the glass. And I was washing my hands in hot water, and I looked at it, and I thought, you know, all you have to do is take that and slice your wrist and hold them under the hot water, and you can go to sleep forever and not have to worry and be embarrassed by this and flunk out. And I looked at myself in the mirror and said, are you crazy? You let this guy do that to you when you know what you did was not an F. So I said, okay. I washed my face, went down, and I slept. I got up the next morning, and I studied that whole weekend except for Mass and for breaking for breakfast and lunch and dinner. I studied. And so the following morning, it was around noon, because I took the two exams, which I passed, which was fine, and I knew I had done all right. And I took my paper, and I went to his office, and he's sitting there. He said, you finally showed up. I said, I threw my paper on his desk, and I said, I know how to do research. I've done research for 3 years. That is not a failing paper. And I told him what had happened. And I said, that is a good paper. I said, and if you insist on giving me an F, I'm going to the dean's office, and I'm going to request that we take the front page off with our names. And my five partners said they would give me copies of their paper, and I want them, all six papers, graded by somebody else and see what they think about this. And he sat back and he said, I knew you were different. And I was shocked. I said, what do you mean? He said, I knew that you had it, that you could be a doctor, even though you were a woman. And I explained to him what had happened to me the Friday night or Saturday morning. And he was shocked. He said, I never meant to harm you. I said, do you understand what you almost did? He said, and he took the paper, and he actually gave me an A. And he said, you know, he apologized. And I said, yeah, you can apologize. And of course I accepted. But you have to understand what you're doing with people's lives. And I said, just because I'm a woman doesn't make me any lesser than any guy. You should have graded the paper according to what the paper deserved, which you just gave me an A. Well, it was interesting because he sent me a Christmas card for years after that. And of course, I passed the course and did fine. But, you know, it was just one of the terrible experiences I had. And it made me even more careful about how to give feedback to people and not to be biased because of anything particular about a person.
It's an amazing story. Thank you for telling that. Now, I'd like to close it off today because we're at an hour and I want to make sure that we are, that I'm going to check the quality of the recording and everything. So I just wanted to ask you if there was anything else you wanted to add today before we close off.
No, whatever it is, we'll do it with the next session. Okay.
Great.
But that's one thing. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. And I know 2021 is going to be better than 2020.
Oh my gosh, it has to be, doesn't it? Yes. Well, yeah, a wonderful holiday too. And in your protected corner there, it's nice to know yeah. you're going to be nice and safe.
I want to turn this around and show you what I'm looking at. Is that beautiful?
Oh my gosh, that's gorgeous. And you have snow. I miss snow. I'm a Northeasterner myself.
That's the Delaware River.
It's beautiful. It's great. Oh, I'd love to be able to get up in the morning and look at that for the view. All right. Well, thank you so much.
There you go.
And
you take care now.
Absolutely. Have a good one.
Okay.
Soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.